So really, before we begin, I just want to express a real feeling of, I guess, a karasatov to the people that are taking this program every week. I often have to work here Sunday morning, and my responsibilities in yeshiva, so I stop in and sit in the back and share sometimes. And to really see the simchas halimud, and to see the excitement generated by the shirim, much more than often the daily shirim that are given. The daily shirim guys come in and they're sort of hunched over their notebooks, and they're afraid to say anything, and they're afraid to, almost get into it sometimes. And to come to these shirim to see the real simcha, the real excitement about learning, something that for me always gives me a lift when I'm here, and really has a real hashvah on the entire yeshiva. What I want to discuss today, obviously, is the topic of mechiras chametz. Mechiras chametz itself is a very, very complex topic, and a topic that has gone through many, many permutations and much development over the course of the last couple thousand years. And the first question to deal with and to address regards to mechiras chametz is, is there anything wrong with doing mechiras chametz? Is mechiras chametz what is classically known as a harama, as a circumvention of what should be done in the first place? And obviously the question is, how do we define and how do we understand the mitzvah of tashbisu? We know the Torah tells us that one must get rid of all the chametz, right, from their property. And there's a very famous chakira, anybody know who? Of the Minchas Chinuch, how to understand this concept of tashbisu. Does tashbisu mean that your house has to be literally free of chametz? That one cannot be over on the lav of Ayirah, by Yimatzeh, that one cannot own chametz in their possession, and whatever means one rids chametz of their home, that's okay. If you have no chametz in the first place, that's also okay. Or is the mitzvah tashbisu much more proactive, that one literally has to destroy the chametz that's in their possession? One can't just make their house chametz free passively, but there must be an active process of destroying chametz. And if so, maybe even mechir is part of that active process of destroying chametz. The first question is, maybe there's no need in the first place, there's no problem with mechir's chametz. The goal is, again, to have your house free of chametz. And even if you say that actively one must do tashbisu, maybe by actively selling your chametz, that also fulfills the mitzvah tashbisu. Perhaps there's no problem with mechir in the first place, there's no circumvention by mechir in the first place. Others seem to say maybe not that way. Others seem to say that tashbisu literally has to be a physical burning, a throwing out. A mechiras chametz that is temporary does not properly fulfill tashbisu and is simply a circumvention of the proper way of doing tashbisu in the first place. Those are the two.
Would you make the same argument?
Right, so that's really what the Rishonim struggle with Bittul Chametz. In other words, as some Rishonim say that what Bittul Chametz really is, and this is the Ramban and Pesachim and Daf Zayin and Aleph, a very, very famous Ramban, that what Bittul Chametz really is a destruction, right? What does a person say when they do Bittul Chametz? I'm now transforming this piece of bread. You think this is an Entenmann's box of cookies. I'm now transforming it into dust, right? So really what is a psychological, emotional destruction of chametz, as opposed to mechir, one would never say that. Mechir is simply getting the chametz out of your house so you don't have to go ahead and destroy it. Just to pick up on what this gentleman said, there's a fascinating havamina by the Maram Chalava Misachin, where he said the following. Once I have done bittul chametz, right, am I then allowed to go ahead and eat it? Sounds like a crazy question. But maybe if I take this tape recorder, assume this is a piece of bread, and I psychologically and emotionally transform this into dust, it's no longer bread. Maybe I can now go ahead and eat this piece of dust, this piece of bread, because it's no longer so bittul. So obviously you don't do that. I don't want you going home and walk down the streets holding a hamburger and Pesach in a bun. But obviously that underlies the fact that even by bittul, we show them are sensitive to make it into something which is actively destructive, as opposed to something which is just passive or making something ownerless. So that's really the first question. The first question is mechiras chametz circumventing the mitzvah tashbisu, or is that all that the mitzvah tashbisu does is tell us to avoid bayira bayimatze, whatever means you have at your disposal, avoiding bayira bayimatze, that's not a problem, even doing mechiras chametz as well. The second question that I just want to address, which I guess is a more global question, is the question about harama in general, circumventions in general, and how we feel about them. How do we feel about circumventing what the Torah wants from us? Well, what's a classic case, or several classic cases, where harama is something which has been mandated either by the Gemara or beyond the Gemara, even in the time of Mishnayos.
Ma'aseh behema.
So ma'aseh behema would be one example. What's even something which is what?
B'chor behema.
By Prusbol is another example. Prusbol we know obviously.
Heter iska.
Heter iska. To avoid the fact that one can't charge interest, right? Anybody who's familiar with the situation in Eretz Yisrael, obviously the heter mechira. That when it comes to Shvi'is, we're allowed to go ahead according to many, many achronim. And because we know we're going to lose so much money from not working on our land, so therefore the obligation is, or there's a heter, according to some, to sell your land to the local Arabs, continue to get profits from it, and that would be a way of avoiding, right, Shvi'is. How do we feel about such a thing? How do we feel about Prisbol? Doesn't it seem like this is, if not hypocrisy, certainly a way of getting out of that which the Torah had mandated in the first place? So I think definitely an approach to understanding harama is to realize that obviously that there is a dual level, a dichotomy, and often our approach to mitzvot. Right? This time, which Nefesh HaChayim speaks about at the end of Shar Aleph, right? That there is the spiritual aspect of mitzvot, the Tamei HaMitzvot, the impact the mitzvot is supposed to have on who we are, right? I guess the spiritual essence of what the mitzvah wants from us. And then also there's the contract that we have with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, that we are God's servants. God gave the Torah as a halachic binding contract on us. Not so much related to the spiritual growth from the mitzvah, but from the contract of needing to fulfill the halacha. When it comes to harama, harama is often a way of getting us out of that binding contract. The Torah tells us, the halacha is phrased in such a way that we have to do X, Y, and Z. We'll find a way to circumvent that process so that we're not over in any yisurim, that we've not done anything inappropriate. But then the question always remains, even though we found a way of getting out of that contract, have we violated the spirit of the law? Have we violated that aspect of the law, the more tamei hamitzvot aspect? So by Prisbol, the approach seems to be that we have not. The whole idea of why there was supposed to be a release of loans in the first place was to help out those people that were aniyim, those people that were poor, those people that needed money. By allowing for a Prisbol system, so that's not at all conflicting with the deeper meaning of the mitzvah. Prisbol system is essentially that now, me, a person that has money, or some money, that now I still have to pay that loan back, right? The Prisbol is not at all circumventing the deeper reason of why there was a release of loans. The release of loans is there for the aniyim, and therefore by going ahead and creating a Prisbol system, we have not violated or negated or gone against the spirit of what the Torah wants from us. So that's the harama, where we get out of the halachic, I guess, nuances, but at the same time not violating at all the spirit of what the Torah wants from us. That was the real discussion by the Heter Mechira as well. You know, there's a gigantic conflict by the Heter Mechira between Rav Kook and many other people. Rav Kook himself, as we all know, was someone that was basically terrorized his entire life, for lack of a better word. And there are many, many issues that people are upset about Rav Kook about. Right? Anybody know the primary issue? Anybody know why was Rav Kook so, made people so angry, right? So for us, maybe it seems like a different issue nowadays. Rav Kook was always very accommodating and sensitive to chilonim, and every chiloni in Eretz Yisrael is a bar kedusha, and then the beauty of even people living in Eretz Yisrael. But one other major issue which got people so upset was exactly this issue of the heter mechira. Rav Kook felt that the only way the country could survive at its beginning inception was to allow people to work during Shemitah. And that's what made people incensed, this idea. So the whole machlokas really was whether this heter mechira of selling land works in the first place. Based on the letter of the law, technically, does the heter mechira work or not? So the Tziv wrote in the Tshuva, forget about that question, but does doing the heter mechira completely go against the ta'am, the spiritual nature of the mitzvah in the first place? Don't ask a question about the contract, but is this harama going against the whole essence of the mitzvah of Shemitah in the first place? And that was the Nitziv's problem, and that's where the question sometimes we might have on Chiras Chametz also. Technically, there may be a way of getting out of it, but maybe on a deeper level, have we avoided that which the Torah wants us to do? And that goes back again to the question of what is the nature of the mitzvah of Tashvisu. I think in order to understand Mechiras Chametz and how we've gotten to the point that we have Mechiras Chametz nowadays, it's important to sort of take a step back.
Go ahead, Yoni. How do we get out of the Darshan Chayim of the Kodesh? Are we saying, oh, since we know the reason?
Right. That is true, but it's telling that. You're right. I mean, that's why, in general, the Rishonim have a hard time with Harama, because what the Rashbala said with Sefer Beitzah, there's different Haramas are different. There's certain Haramas where we feel we do know the reason, right? This is in general, but why by Gezeros? Why is there Bizman Hazed? If there's certain, Gezeros that we do feel that we can go ahead and not necessarily listen to Bizman Hazed, other ones we do. The Rashbala says exactly this issue. By Harama, we can't necessarily always make a decision, right, if we understand completely the nature of the mitzvah, and then it's circumventing it a problem or not. And the Rashba felt there's certain cases where we do have that option, right? So that's why it becomes tricky. When is there an option to circumvent the mitzvah, and when is there no option? But that's not what Shacharonim have dealt with, for that reason. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so the question as far as what is the history and the various stages of Mechiras Chametz? The truth is, Mechiras Chametz, if you have the packet in front of you, is something which has been done even in the time back of the Gemara. The Mishnah tells us, again, in the beginning of the second paragraph of Sechet Tzachin, so it says, Kol Shah Shemutr Lechol, right, any hour where a person is allowed to eat the Chametz, so Machil Behema L'Chai L'Ofos, Umocher L'Nochri, you can also sell during that whole fourth hour and fifth hour, you can also go ahead and you can sell it to a Nochri as well. Umutr B'Hanah, so it's also Mutr B'Hanah, so others Mano Asr B'Hanah, so, but once that time has passed, you can no longer get Hanah. So there was a point, there was a moment before chametz became asur b'hanah, where one would be allowed to go ahead and sell their chametz if need be. There wasn't the din that every single piece of chametz had to be destroyed, but during that period of time, it was mutter al pi din to sell chametz. What type of sale was this mechiras chametz referred to in the Mishnah? So if you look, we won't read inside in the Gemara and Pesachim and Daf Yud Gimel Aleph. There was a situation, a scenario, where Jew A went to Jew B and said the day before Pesach, do you mind watching some of this chametz for me? I don't know why he agreed to this in the first place, right? I don't know if his wife was around when they saw this transaction. Right, do you mind watching this chametz for me? I'm going to keep it in your house. The guy never comes back, right? Now already it's the day before Pesach, and he goes to Rebbe and says, what should I do with the chametz? Rebbe says, wait an hour, wait 2 hours, wait. And by the end of the hour, he says, you know what? Sell the chametz. Mechira b'shuk, sell the chametz in the marketplace itself. So there was a mechira that was done, albeit that mechira was a mechira b'shuk, right? It wasn't any type of joke. It wasn't, I'm going to sell it to you now and we'll get it back later. It was a mechira. I have my chametz. Give me $100 for those barrels of whiskey, and then we'll go on our own way. That was the mechira that was done, clearly back in the time of the Gemara. And there's no other allusion to any type of other mechira getting us out of the problem of tashbisu, ridding our house of chametz. That was the mechira that was done. A mechira b'shuk, right, where the deal was a complete deal. Where we get into trouble was the Tosefta. Right? The Tosefta goes on to describe...
wasn't there haram?
There was no haram at all. Okay. So he actually photocopied the wrong Tosefta. Okay. So what the Tosefta says, forget about your sheet for a moment. So he's trying to make sure that I'm awake. So what the Tosefta says is the following. The Tosefta says, let's say you're in a scenario. Anybody know this famous Tosefta? Anybody? What's that?
The ship.
So Gary points out the ship. So it's this ship, right, that began the entire range of problems. So the Tosefta, is there Pesach here? No. Okay. So the Tosefta points out the following. The Tosefta says, let's say it's before Pesach. Any excitement in halacha usually takes place on a ship. People always find themselves on ships like at weird times. This is like the common, like the predecessor of going on cruises. So the Tosefta says, let's say the following scenario where you have a Jew and a non-Jew that went on a ship together, right? All of a sudden, it's Pesach, and the guy has his entire stash of Entenmann donuts with him. So he goes to... was that... So he goes, I guess he didn't want to burn them. He knew that he would be chalishing for Entenmann's when Pesach's finished. I was in a very funny scenario when I grew up in Baltimore. Anybody here who lives in Long Island, probably the same thing also. So we Dunkin' Donuts by our house. I would never ever go to Dunkin' Donuts. Maybe once a month I'll go to Dunkin' Donuts. But after Pesach, I needed a Dunkin' Donut. So you go there with the rest of Mishugayim, waiting in line for 2 hours outside Dunkin' Donuts, waiting for a Boston cream donut. So that was the same thing with the Tosefta. So he knew, he sold the chametz before Pesach. And he knew that he wanted to buy it back afterwards. So he told the person, right, I'm going to go ahead and buy the and sell you my chametz, I'm going to sell you the donuts, right? And then he goes back afterwards, and he goes and he buys back the donuts afterwards. And the second part of the Tosefta also is significant. The second part of the Tosefta says there's another scenario. He's also on a ship. And a Jew goes to the non-Jew and says, Acha ta, right, kone bimana tikach bimal sayim. What does it mean, until you take for 100, take for 200? It's a very ambivalent phrase of the Tosefta. What does that mean? So Rabbeinu Manoach gives the most, I guess, placid answer for the Tosefta means. And Rabbeinu Manoach pointed out that what it means is, you're going to, right, Supersol now. You're buying for yourself $100 worth of chametz. I know that after Pesach, I'm going to have chametz also. So instead of buying $100 worth of chametz, buy $200 worth of chametz. And then I'll come and I'll buy for you afterwards. That's the way the Rabbeinu Manoach understood this Tosefta. But others understand it differently. Others understand it where they turn around the girsa of the Tosefta, where it says, Achatikach b'ma'asayin, instead of buying for 200, you want to go to person X and buy chametz, you want to go to the store and buy $200 worth of chametz. So tikach b'mana, buy for me for only $100 worth of chametz, I'll give you a special deal where you'll buy my chametz for $100, and then I'm going to go back afterwards, and that's the way we're going to send Tosefta, and buy that from you. So I'll sell you my chametz for cheaper, because I'm going to go back afterwards and buy that chametz back from you. That's the Tosefta. So the way that it's brought down the halacha, so the Bahag has the following girsa. The Bahag has the girsa of the Tosefta, which we don't have in front of us, that one is allowed to be on the ship. One is allowed to go before Pesach and say, I'm going to sell to you my chametz, and I'm going to buy back from you after chametz. As long as there's no, says the Bahag, as long as there's no harama, as long as there's no circumvention of the system, I'm allowed to sell to you my chametz and buy it back from you afterwards. So what's the obvious question on this Bahag? And that Bahag says that's the gears of the Tosefta. What's the problem? Anybody? Right? So the way, was that?
Maybe the boy wants to keep it.
So maybe, so that would be the best. I mean, if someone goes ahead and says, I want to keep it, that really shows you it was a good sale in the first place. You go, Judah?
There was no harama because the money issue.
Right, okay, so maybe even before we get to that, but the whole thing seems like a harama. He says, I'm going to go ahead and say my chametz now, I'm going to buy back afterwards, as long as there's no harama, as long as there's no circumvention. But you might say this whole thing is a circumvention. Here it is, the entire essence of the din of the Tosefta, both the first part, I'm going to sell two, I'm going to buy back, A, or B, according to other Rishonim, the Aguda, the Rashbah, I'm going to sell you chametz for less money than you normally pay for, because I'm going to buy that for you afterwards. The whole essence of the din is one which is fraught, and one which is defined and determined by harama. So what do you mean that you can do this deal as long as there is no harama? The whole nature seems to be that of a circumvention.
There is a certain harama there.
What's that?
There is a certain harama there.
Right, and that is. So Beis Yosef says on the Bahag, right? The Bahag says that this is the girsa itself of the Tosefta, right? But the Beis Yosef seems to understand that this is what the Bahag himself added in. And the Beis Yosef asks the Bahag, what do you mean as long as there is no harama? The whole thing is a harama. If I give to you as a gift and I say I'm going to get back afterwards, isn't that itself a harama? So what the Beis Yosef said, at least understood by the Chasam Sofer, is the following. That one could go ahead and create a harama. I'm selling it to you as a way of getting out the Isser of owning chametz. I'm going to buy back afterwards. That's not a problem, right? That seems to be Pshat and Tosefta. That's not a problem. What the Tosefta meant, or the Bahag meant when it says, as long as there is no harama, it means that you have to have a mechir gemura. I have to sell the chametz to you completely. I can't go to you and say, I'm selling you $100 worth of chametz for a nickel. I can't go ahead and do the sale in an incomplete fashion. So even though the whole nature of the din seems to be a circumvention, as long as the mechira itself is a complete mechira, as long as the mechira works based on the din of Chosh and Mishpat, right, that the mechira is a valid mechira, we're not concerned about it. So the Beis Yosef again questions the Tosefta, how can you say there's no harama? Isn't the whole thing harama? So he answers, at least under Subal Chasam Sofer, as long as the Mechira is a valid Mechira, we don't care about the fact that you're circumventing the system of not owning Chametz on Pesach. And that's the way that Chasam Sofer ended. Right? And that's the way, at least in stage two, that the Mechaber brings down this din in Shulchan Aruch. Simtaf Memches Sif Gimel. So stage one, the Gemara was that people used to really sell the chametz and they're not expected to get it back. Stage two was the Tosefta that said they would sell to get it back, but as long as the mechir was done properly, we're not concerned about it. And that was the second stage of the Gemara as elucidated by the Tosefta. There's one problem with this, right? And the problem was, if you look at the Mechaber, in number six, so it says, "Chametz shall Yisrael she'ava alav haPesach." So aser b'hanav, right? So chametz shall Yisrael she'ava alav haPesach aser b'hanav, right? Afilu hinichu shogeg onos, right? That it's aser b'hanav once you have chametz in your possession during Pesach, so I can't get hanav from it afterwards. What by the way, is the major question that comes up in regards to us, in regards to this mechaber? What's that? Supermarkets. So since the Hakhazer pointed out, there's always a big machlokas about supermarkets. It's very unclear exactly how to respond. But supermarkets will go ahead and they'll sell their chametz, right? They'll sell their chametz to John Brown, whoever the person may be, and then they turn around and they continue to sell their stuff afterwards, right? So if that's the case, so that it seems that it might have invalidated the whole deal in the first place. That's a big machlokas of Moshe and Rav Soloveitchik. What should we do? The different places are different. I know the key food here, anybody here live in Washington Heights? Yeah. I think the key food here says not to buy the pasta for what, 90 days, 60 days, whatever the case is. Because maybe we say that invalidated the sale, so that's really based on this mechaber. V'im machru nosnu le'enu Yehudi, shemichutz labayis kodim ha-Pesach. Even though I sold it to the non-Jew and I know he's not going to touch it, rather the non-Jew is just going to guard it after Pesach, and then he's going to go back and give it back to him. Mutter, right? That's mutter. This is the Beis Yosef. As long as the mechira is a full mechira, the belishum tanai, without any type of tanai built into it. Oshim grand lo mechira gemura b'davar muat. Or as long as he does a sale with him. Avam matana manasa hachzer lo mahani. But one cannot do a matana manasa hachzer. Right? Maybe we'll spend a second on this did. Matana manasa hachzer, I give something to Chazan Khan on the condition that he gives it back to me afterwards. Normally, is that a valid matana or not? Right? That's what in most cases, who's now considered to be the owner of this object if I give it to you on the condition that you'll give it back to me after a month? Is matana manasa hachzer normally a valid kinyan? If let's say by lulav on sukkahs, if I go ahead and I give you matana manasa hachzer, right, do you own that lulav or not? Are you allowed to use that lulav? Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. Well, what's the case in the Gemara, from an interesting note, where we say one should not do matana manasa hachzer? One should not do this matana on the tanai of getting it back afterwards? A very interesting case, man. So by a katan, so katan was its own complexity by lulav. But the Gemara says a kedushin one should not go ahead. I'm not sure if this person should get married in the first place. That's a different story. That's more for a psychologist than for a shir. So a chasan should not be under the chuppah and give a ring to his kawa on the condition that he gets it back afterwards. Right? Again, this guy has its own issues. So why can you not do that? Isn't that a valid matana? Isn't that in fact a valid kinyan? So he said the woman's going to be essentially so insulted that here it is, this guy is pulling this fast one on me, that she's not going to go ahead and be mocking at herself. She's not going to go ahead and agree for the kedusha in the first place. But matana amanasa hafsir does work. So why in this scenario can I not find a guy, my neighbor in Einstein, say, I'll give you my chametz as a gift now, it's yours, on the condition that I get it back afterwards? Why should we not do that by chametz? So anybody, so there's really two days brought down the acharonim. The first day is that normally that would work. There's no problem with that. But by chametz, we try to have higher standards in general. For instance, Moshe Feinstein points out that normally, one does not have to kosher their burners. So if you have a burner in an oven, you don't have to kosher the top of them, even if you bought that oven from a non-Jew, a person who was eating treif beforehand. But by Pesach, because our standards are higher, therefore we should cover or kosher the burners. So too, that's a post can say here as well, even though matana manasa hachzer does work, over here we don't want to do it. But the Bir HaLachos is not that way. The Bir HaLachos is an interesting idea. What if I give it to my neighbor who's not Jewish, on the condition that he gives it back to me after Pesach? And then, he never gives it back to me. So whose chametz is it now? It's my chametz. Because he never fulfilled the terms of the deal by giving it back to me. So even though it's in his possession, because he never fulfilled that tanai, therefore the chametz really belongs to me. So we're concerned that l'mafreya, retroactively, I'm going to be the owner of the chametz, therefore it's a problem, so therefore that's why the Rishonim say, you cannot do matan amanasa hachzer. But the din the Mechaber brought down is that the Eino Yehudi himself has to be mechutz l'bayis, cannot be in your house. You can't have a cleaning lady who's not Jewish sell her the chametz and then keep the chametz in your possession, because then the whole thing appears as a total joke. She thinks it's a joke, you think it's a joke, and therefore you have to sell to an Eino Yehudi that's outside of your house. So the problem with the Truma Sadesh, the problem with the Mechaber is the following. The Mechaber was basing himself on the Truma Sadesh. And the Truma Sadesh, the Lashon, as the Beis Yosef himself quotes, is not that the Eino Yehudi has to be outside of your house, but that the Chometz itself has to leave your house. Not just that the person you're selling to has to be your neighbor, not someone who's in your home, but the Chometz itself, in the time of the Tosefta, the stage 2 Mechiras Chometz, could not be in your possession. It had to actually leave your possession. Why was that? So the Truma Sadesh explains that either A, we're concerned that you'll go ahead and you'll eat it, or B, we're concerned that if you're selling chametz, your own chametz, and it's still in your house, your entire mentality is going to be that this mechiras chametz is a joke, the person's going to think it's a joke, and therefore they never allowed such a mechira to have the chametz in your house. They always made you take the chametz outside of your house. So that all changed around the time of the Bach, right? Anybody know what the circumstances were around the Bach that made this entire din change, which now brings us to where we are nowadays? Anybody just know sort of the history of Jewish finance and the jobs that Jews had? Liquor owners. So when the Jews were, so they were liquor owners, right? It's sort of like a funny possession if you think about it now, a profession. I'm not sure how many people would want to tell their parents now that they're in, they sell liquor, they own taverns for a living, but they used to own taverns, right? And they would have, obviously, a tremendous amount of whiskey and scotch and other things in their possession. And it wasn't simply realistic, says the Bach 300 years ago, to go ahead and to sell the chametz and take the chametz out of the possession of the Jew, right? And therefore, they had to create a scenario where even though the chametz remained in the possession of the Jew, right, then there would still be mechira. So the problem with that was the following. The problem with that was, if let's say a Jew owns Pathmark, right? And that's always a question, who exactly owns Pathmark? It's maybe time for a different year, right? And then I want to sell to a local non-Jew. So I say, I'll sell you the chametz of Pathmark. Can you write me a check for $10 billion, right? So that obviously would never happen. So instead what would happen is that the non-Jew who is buying the stuff from Pathmark, or in the case of the Bach, would give $5 as a down payment on that chametz. If you go to, I mean, here when Rabbi Willig sells chametz with John Brown, so you go to Rabbi Willig, so I have chametz for my entire shul in Einstein, $1,000 worth of chametz, and he gives me, $2 for all that chametz as a down payment for the rest of the money afterwards. So as a result of that, as a result of this stage, people end up being convinced that the mechira is not a real mechira. I'm selling my entire warehouse, I'm selling all my stuff, I'm getting that $2 back in return, it's staying in my house, so people were convinced that the mechira itself was a joke. So the Acharonim at the time of the Bach said, we have to do things to bolster and make more serious the mechira. So they said, any type of kinyan that we can possibly manage to throw into the deal, we're going to go ahead and do that. So there was the kinyan through kesef, right? What's the problem with the kinyan kesef under these circumstances, by the way? If I just go ahead and I have the chametz in my possession and you give me $10 for it, what seems to be the problem with that type of mechira? So there's never ever meshicha. He gives me money, but he never took it. He never lifted it. That was a kinyan without meshicha, which according to some people is not good. There was never any the taking of that which a person paid money for. So they also instituted they would pay money for the home. So if you live in your home and you're selling chametz, you don't just buy the chametz itself, but you buy the apartment, you buy the home, you buy the closets. And maybe because that wasn't good enough, they'd also institute a shtar, they'd institute a document that would be signed between the Jew and the non-Jew. And maybe that wasn't good enough also. So there would be the situmta, the normal way the business would be transacted, which would be a handshake. I don't know if people still conduct business through handshakes, but at least that's the way that used to be. So they would conduct business through a handshake, so that's what was done also. Then on top of that, they threw in, because maybe those kinyanim are not good between a Jew and a non-Jew, chalipin, which would be the way that we often see kinyanim. A person takes their yarmulke or the handkerchief, and there's another transaction. And on top of that also, to top off that whole list, there was a need for mesiras mafteach, for the passing of the key. If you have your home, and you close up your home, and you go to Florida, and you lock it, and you take your keys with you, and then you tell your local rabbi to sell your chametz, you've done absolutely nothing by doing that, because there's no entrance way, and there's no ability to get the chametz from your home. So what was needed on top of that, according to the Acharonim, would be at least a mesiras mafteach, a giving of the key, or at least telling the person where they can access your apartment as well. So all five things were necessary. Mesiras mafteach, a handshake deal, chalipin, kinyan kesef, and kinyan shtar as well. So what the Acharonim found out 150 years ago was that this had turned into a total disaster, right? Imagine the average businessman knowing how to do these five different type of kinyanim and to actually sell the chametz properly. The Maggid of Ram records, again, it's some Tafim Ches, that people used to do the following. I thought that I was selling my stuff, so they would sell the key. Right? Here's my key, I'll sell it to you for $3. And the person thought that would be the way of selling chametz. It's a total joke, it wasn't true. So the Acharonim realized that they had to change the way in which the business was done. And instead of a person themselves selling chametz, the local Rav or the Beis Din themselves would sell chametz for the entire community. And that's where we're left to on stage four. Stage one was the real mechira. Stage two, that is a mechira with a quasi harama, but the chametz still left the rishus. Stage three was the problem of the bakhris, right? That all the chametz was too much to sell, and therefore they'd have to go ahead and keep it in your possession. And stage four was that the rav of the community would go ahead and do it. The Mekor Chai, the Nesivas, raises two problems with the rav of the community selling the chametz for everybody. Well, what might be a problem in the current scenario where one person sells for everybody? So I mentioned a very humorous aside as we're doing this. So again, most of the local rabbanim sell with Rabbi Willick, they sell John Brown. That's a sort of funny name, John Brown. People in my community feel like John Brown's like a made-up name, like a generic person. So John Brown's a real person. So Rabbi Willick was traveling a number of years ago to Israel after selling chametz for many, many years to John Brown, and he sees John Brown in line in El Al. So he says, "Oh, John, so where are you going?" Right? So it says, "Oh, my grandson's bar mitzvah is in Israel." This was after 20 years, and I really has these visions of of 1,000 people being over and he's through the rice. So that's what he's usually done, though. So people, the world would sell to John Brown. I hope that one year, hoping John Brown actually comes to someone's apartment. So he takes the key, comes in, your scotch is missing. That would convince people that it's something which is obviously done on a serious level. So what's the problem, though, with one person selling for the entire community in this vein? It's not so clear what the problem is, but Mekor Chayim raised two objections. The first problem is that if you have me, a person, selling for 100 other people, and then we have a shtar between the Rav and the person who you're selling to, so then according to some Acharonim, you would need the names and the signatures of the entire community on that shtar. It's not enough that I sign it, someone else signs it. All that I have is a power of attorney to have on someone else's behalf. But maybe there's a need also for the signatures and the assessment and the agreement of the entire community on that shtar, which we don't do. That's problem number one. Problem number two, the Mekor Chayim said, based on the Gemara and Kedushin, is that if I sell something on someone else's behalf, right? So I get the dollar that I get from John Brown, I put it in my pocket, I give it back to him, and that's it. But if you want to make a sale that's valid, wouldn't you need the money actually going back to the people in the community itself, right? Who says that you can have a rebel community selling, getting money back in return, and never dispersing that money to the people who really deserve the money, instead of just throwing it out or spending it on something else? So the Nesivah said, this was not a mechanism which is valid, and therefore one should not do it this way. And many other Acharonim also said that to have one person sell is not valid, it's not something which one should do. At the end of the day, the Acharonim felt this was the best method of selling chametz. But it should be noted, as we come to a conclusion, that according to many Acharonim, this mechiras chametz gets us out of a problem of an iser d'oraisa, a din d'oraisa. So you would say, why would this get us out of a problem in iser d'oraisa? Don't we have the concept of the bittul chametz, where I'm now making the chametz ownerless, I'm now negating this chametz? So why should mechiras chametz also get us out of a problem of an iser d'oraisa, right? So the Acharonim respond is no. If I sell chametz afterwards, I negate, I am vatel, I make chametz ownerless, and then I go ahead and I say, you know what, I want to sell my whiskey. What I'm essentially doing is saying that bittul chametz in the first place was meaningless. That bittul chametz, where I say I'm making this ownerless, and then I turn around and say, you know what, I want to sell it, I'm essentially saying that bittul chametz and those objects meant nothing. And therefore, when a person does mechiras chametz, which he should do, you're essentially showing that your bittul is meaningless, and now you're getting yourself out of a problem of the iser deraisa by your rabbi, you must say, by going ahead and selling your chametz. So if that's the case, and this is a potential iser deraisa, according to many acharonim, therefore one must approach this with a sense of seriousness, right? That the mechira has to be a real mechira, there has to be a real matne das to go ahead and do this, and a person should realize that what they're doing is getting themselves out of the potential iser deraisa. This is one of many, many areas of complexity of getting ready for Pesach, and there's another area where we see also the difficulty of our approach to chametz. Have a good day.